Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Lisa Brennan Jobs about her life growing up in the rapidly changing Silicon Valley, and her father, Steve Jobs, described as a mythical figure rarely present in her life. We're going to begin the program in conversation with Jonathan Maul, a writer, performer, and musician. He's just released Whole Night Through, a soundtrack to the novella in verse. KVCR's Benjamin Perper has more.
Jonathan Maul, welcome to the program. So I want to first focus on you and your background. Describe your kind of musical journey for me.
I started as a percussionist. You know, I went to music school in Hollywood and studied percussion. I was 19 years old and moved from Boise, Idaho to Hollywood with a BMX bicycle and a duffel bag full of clothes and an inflatable mattress and, of course, my drums. And I went to Musicians Institute and you know, I was playing with some bands and doing the starving artist thing in Hollywood for a while, waiting tables, playing shows, sleeping in my little rehearsal space that I had at the school, and, you know, having a lot of fun, but it was really hard. But, you know, that's my background, is in percussion and drums and playing mostly rock music live. But, you know, the first instrument I played was piano, so I'm having kind of a return to the original influences now during stay at home and over the past year and a half, playing piano more synthesizers and things like that. You know, so playing drums and piano, they're really simpatico, both percussive instruments. And I've played in, you know, church bands, I've played in hardcore metal bands, I've played in reggae bands, you know, just wanted to play out, wanted to perform. I really enjoy that. So my background is kind of varied. I even did a couple professional gigs in Hollywood. One was for a music video and a commercial, you know, things like that. I was just trying to get work during that time. So I was pretty open in terms of genres and styles. But you know, with all this technology, now I'm able to play a whole host of instruments using MIDI instruments, using a keyboard that I can run into my computer. And so it makes it nice for not only recording music at home, but doing so on a budget. And, you know, my background is not in the art of getting mics placed and mixing and mastering, and that's a whole other discipline that I have a lot of respect for. That's not my strong suit. So doing the digital music has been a way for me to stay in the work and write and record stuff from an apartment or a small house. And as a renter, that's key.
Yeah. We'll get to instrumentation later and MIDI, but how did the idea to make this soundtrack come about? I imagine you maybe started playing stuff in response to Whole Night Through, and that's how it came about, or how did it kind of take shape?
Well, I'm really inspired by my wife, Eli Henley. Her work is really stirring to me, and not just because I'm, you know, married to her, but I really respect her work. And so I was really close to that novella in verse to begin with, because I had read it, devoured it, enjoyed it so much. And then you know, she asked me to be part of a staged reading for one of the characters. So I felt really intimate with that piece. And then it just sort of came up as a conversation, you know. She and I collaborate on a lot of different creative projects, and she's wonderful to work with. So it also works for she and I that we tend to spin each other up and get excited, and then the other one will get even more excited. And so then we have these kinds of ambitious projects that we get into. And so it was really just that, you know, she wrote this amazing thing that I enjoyed so much. And then we had a conversation and I started, and it wasn't until I was a few months in that I realized the scope of this thing and realized how how much it was to chew on, you know, how difficult the project was at hand, and it grew from something relatively succinct to what it is now at 32 tracks. So a lot of different iterations there, but that's how it started.
Yeah, and for listeners, the entire novella isn't recited throughout the album, but certain scenes are. And so how did you decide on that format, deciding to do certain scenes from the book recited like that?
Right. We had talked about, you know, that this process is so recursive. Writing and any creative project, I think, is recursive, or it ought to be. And so, you know, there were a lot of conversations between my wife and I. And so, you know, it kind of went into this accordion style thing where it got big and then it got small and then big and small. And, you know, if you think about doing a track for every poem, that's impossible, really. It's just too big and unwieldy. So instead, she chose a selection from the book in order to excerpt, but still have an arc and hopefully have a kind of way into the novella for people who haven't read the whole thing that would stand on its own, but also signal to the larger text. So, you know, again, that's another hard balancing act. How do you excerpt from a larger story that is already hybrid in form and do another hybrid move that hopefully stands on its own, that is accessible enough for people who haven't read the whole book, maybe, but also leaves some mystery and can be its own unique thing. So to answer your question, I mean, we had a lot of conversations and there were a lot of drafts and, you know, a lot of trial and error and coming back to, you know, the drawing board, so to speak, and saying, okay, well, these sounds are working, these poems are central, so we'll stick to that and keep trying to drill down there.
Yeah, I have read the book, but I can see how, if I hadn't read the book already, listening to the whole album would make me want to read it even more.
Oh, good. Thank you. That was, that's the goal. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Helena, your daughter's gone. I don't know what it means to be gone. I feel she's somewhere close, but behind a scrim. Either that, or she's in front of the curtain, seeing everything that ever was, and the whole world is hidden behind.
So who are the featured speakers on this album? You have people that you feature who recite some of the poems, right?
Yeah, we do, and we were really fortunate to have such amazing talent here. Well, I read for the part of Jake, and then we have Marcia De La O, and we have Madeline Morey, and Kristen Bach, and James Cushing. And they're all unique readers, and the voices, their literal voices are very distinct. And then the poems that they're reading, the language in the poems and the characters themselves are distinct. And so I feel like these readers did such an amazing job. I'm so grateful for them. But I was trying to, you know, really heighten their individuality in each of these poems and each of their readings and allow the music to uplift and be a container for each individual reading. So if you hear, you know, Cushing's reading of Michael, it's very different than Maddie's reading of Ella. And, you know, that's pretty apparent if you listen to just the first couple tracks.
Yeah, absolutely. So now to the music itself, what was your writing process like for these songs or these tracks?
Well, I started last year, and when I began, it was kind of a blind casting out. I read the book half dozen times, and I was really trying to get into not only each specific voice, each specific character, but some of the themes central to the entire book. And there's a lot of sadness and tragedy in the book, but there's also moments of levity, and there's a way of, you know, Lauren has this way of taking a heavy subject matter and shining the light of humanity on it. So reading the work and staying sort of focalized in the book itself was key. So I read that several times. And then I actually decided to do something that I've never done before, because I've never done a project like this before. So I thought, hey, it's all new, let's experiment. So I decided to assign each character a color and an animal to try to get in their vibe and their feeling. And so I can't really articulate this through language, which is maybe a cop out when we're doing this kind of interview. But, you know, like for Helena, I just thought, well, there's purple in these poems and in these words and in her reading. So what does that sound like? Well, I heard cellos. So I just went with that, you know. And Lauren's so cool with me experimenting. She said, yeah, go, boy, do. Try it out. Let's see what sticks to the wall. So then there was a, you know, once I had sort of a color and an animal and this kind of way that these readings wanted to move, then I could get a sound palette, so to speak. I knew where there was going to be more percussion and where there was going to be maybe a little less, but there was still a ton of experimentation and quite a few tracks that ended up on the cutting room floor because they were, you know, neat and interesting at the time, but they didn't fit in the larger sort of track list.
That's interesting. So some of the songs didn't make it in then, or tracks didn't make it in.
Yeah, I was I was experimenting quite a bit, and experimentation is awesome, but you also have to be able to, you know, put your feet on the ground sometimes and make those decisions where you're like, you know, if you listen to 10 songs and one of them is such an outlier, maybe save it for another project. That's fine. It doesn't mean that it's no good. It just means, you know, if this is something that studying poetry formally has really helped me with, it's if there's something that can be removed from a piece and it does no damage, in fact, it heightens the work, you already have your answer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with Jonathan Maul. We're hearing mainly about Whole Night Through, a soundtrack to the novella in verse. This is a body of work which was released as a response to L.I. Henley's novella in verse, Whole Night Through. Find more at jonathanmaul.com. That's Jonathan Maul, MAULE.com. We'll also have more in just a few minutes. Later in the program, we have Emmanuel Rogers exploring a coming-of-age story through a memoir by Lisa Brennan Jobs. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR and David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll hear from Lisa Brennan Jobs, the daughter of Steve Jobs. We'll hear about being born on a farm and raised in Silicon Valley. Right now, though, back to KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with Jonathan Maul, who's just released Whole Night Through, a soundtrack to the novella in verse. More at jonathanmaul.com. That's MAULE.
So you mentioned cellos, and I imagine you're doing that with MIDI, right? With synths?
Yeah, ideally I would be, you know, in a beautiful studio with professional musicians and I could just pay them competitive wage and all of that, but that's just not realistic for about 25 reasons. So I'm using Logic Pro, and inside Logic Pro, I have software instruments that I'm able to play using a MIDI keyboard. I also have a digital piano that's the full weighted 88 keys, and I have an electronic drum set. And between the synth, the digital piano, and the electronic drum set, I was able to make all of these sounds and modify them to my liking and add effects and things like that. And that's really exciting for me, because if you think about, I don't know when this really happened, but if you think about 10 or 15 years ago, something like that, these kinds of instruments were either cost prohibitive or they weren't that good. Like, they sounded really tinny. You still get some of those really tinny sounding strings. The strings are the hardest for me to get right, and I would always prefer to have a live musician anyway. But now this software is so incredible and dynamic, and not only that, but the cost has gone down to where, you know, an adjunct college English instructor can can afford some of this stuff. So yeah, if I had my druthers, I'd be working with professional musicians playing actual instruments in a space. But if I stuck to that kind of ideal, this project would never be made, because I can't afford it, and B, I mean, 2020 is not really the year for that kind of thing. It's really solidified for me that working from home in a realistic digital space can work and be viable.
Did you play guitar on this record? Because the guitars sound so realistic. I mean, were those synths too, or MIDI too?
There was an existential sort of Matthew McConaughey moment I had, let's just say, with the guitar, because it's a drummer playing the keyboard, playing the guitar. So, you know, you talk about, a level of removal. And there was some anxiety about that, because I knew guitar players and string, you know, players are gonna listen to this. And I thought, well, if I can fool guitar players, I've done something, right? And so the short answer is, I'm not playing guitar. But the longer answer is, I'm kind of playing guitar.
Well, you fooled me. I'm a guitar player, and I thought you were actually playing guitar, so.
Excellent. Well, that was my goal, which is kind of an interesting goal that kind of, you know, go under the radar, so to speak. I sent an early track to my older brother, who's a phenomenal guitar player, and he said, oh, is that your, he's like, I have a Les Paul knockoff, and he loaned me one of his amps, and he goes, is that the, your guitar? You're running through my amp? And I was like, doing a little dance. I fooled him.
That's great. So what is the instrumentation like? You have the guitar sound and the MIDI sound, and there's strings there, and then there's drums. Was there like bass in there that you added too? I think I heard some of the tracks.
Yeah, there's a kind of classic, you know, Rickenbacker bass tone that I would distort and warp to my liking. And obviously reverb is one of my favorite effects. I love this big wash kind of ambient thing, and that fits with the larger project because it's so dreamy and airy, and you know, the desert sky is just an expanse. And so reverb on a lot of the tracks and all the instruments, but lots of drums. I experimented early on with a modified piano, which would be a sampled piano that has, you know, wood, metal, nails, things bolted onto it and clamped onto it, that was sampled, that then I would, you know, play. Some of those sounds made it in, but I would say very few. To people listening to this, you know, who have heard the album, they might be thinking, where was that? But I realized that, you know, I had to swing out wide and play a lot of those sounds and then taper it and really kind of make it more subtle. That's such an overpowering voice. So there's quite a few pianos, some synth, some noise, and sound effects. Like there's some music boxes and some bizarre metallic sounds that I was really, really into, specifically for Michael, because they're just so desert. I mean, some of these sounds sound like, you know, if you've been out to the high desert, or if you've been out to Wonder Valley, or driven the back road through Amboy to Vegas and seen some of these shotgun blasted shacks, and actually pulled over and been brave enough to walk around inside some of them, the wind and the mood and the atmosphere can do something to you. And you know, I've heard some of these sounds before. So yeah, there are a lot of different instruments, but then the key ones that I stuck to were mainly, you know, some of the cellos, the piano in different iterations, that guitar that you hear in the opening track, In the Pines. I stuck to that kind of voice for a number of tracks because I wanted there to be some sort of continuity with some of the tones. The drums are there and somewhat consistent in the tracks that they're featured. And then there's the bass, obviously, and then some of the sound effects and noise and ambient stuff.
And so the drums were electronic also?
Yeah, my drums are a hybrid kit. Electronic drums have come such a long way too in the past, you know, 5-10 years. And I play on a kit that's sort of a cross between an acoustic and an electronic kit. And so it's an acoustic drum set that I put mesh heads on and then put triggers on. And now I'm playing this thing, and all of that's running in through an interface that then is connected to my computer. So I'm, getting these technological components to speak to one another and then trigger these sounds. But then what's interesting is that the sounds that they're triggering are professionally recorded acoustic drums in a space recorded by an engineer who knows what he's doing, so that I can, sit here and hit something that's just sending a simple digital signal, and it can trigger this really rich, customizable sound that I can, bend to my will, so to speak.
Yeah, it sounded really good. The drums sounded acoustic. I didn't know that they were electronic.
Thank you so much. That's a high compliment. I've experimented with miking and recording drums in the past, but so much of that has been with the benefit of having somebody there who knows what they're doing, so that I can sort of relax and just perform. When I was living in Hollywood, I was able to record a number of times with, in a professional studio, and that was wonderful. And at one point I was able to record onto tape, which was such a fun thing, and it sounded so warm and interesting. But the engineer and their team there had the mic set up and placed for the room, got the baffles, inside half an hour to an hour, they had this amazing drum sound that would have taken me, I'd probably still be working on it now, because there's so many complexities to that kind of thing. And with drums, the room is the sound. So if you're renting like I am, and you don't have the money to create a drum room, well, you're at the mercy of wherever you record it. So my hat's off to everybody who is doing this. Eventually, post-COVID, collaborations will include acoustic mic drums, because that is just a wonderful experience. But for now, I'm glad that I can fool you, with the electronic sounds.
Absolutely. So what's next for you musically? You mentioned that some of the tracks that didn't make it into the soundtrack maybe can be repurposed for another project. What's next for you musically?
Right now I'm working on a project that is loosely titled Nostalgia. I'm looking at next November as a hopeful date for this project to see the light of day, although if you scan the headlines, with COVID and everything, that live show seems further and further away. But regardless, I'm working on tracks that are cinematic, sort of trip hop kind of feel. They've got a lot of moodiness and, again, more electronics, but I'm trying to write with this idea of nostalgia in mind. And this is another collaboration project that, between Lauren, myself, and another artist up in the high desert, Zara Khand, we're planning on this November date, but if that has to be pushed back, it'll happen someday. But they're going to be, three artists, one event, and the theme is nostalgia. So how do you write music that is nostalgic? That's my challenge, that's my question, but I'm trying to do that from a number of angles. And my own belief is that nostalgia can ruin art, because it can get us to see things in a one-dimensional framework or with too much of a sentimental tack. And so the challenge is, how do I kind of approach this idea that we're all susceptible to, this feeling of nostalgia, which probably a lot of us are feeling right now. I hear it in the dominant discourse when people talk about this return to normal, whatever that was. So I'm trying to, get in that frame of mind and write music from that space. And it's a lot of fun. It's very different than the Whole Night Through stuff. There'll be a few more danceable tracks in there, and just enjoying the process of experimenting and, going where the sound moves me and, having fun.
So you're trying to be nostalgic, but still kind of authentic, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way of putting it. I'm trying to become infected by nostalgia just long enough to create a sound that pulls you in as well. And then it's time for the next track, which maybe we view nostalgia from a different emotional proximity, which could be one of, you know, you think about your favorite childhood memory and then think about the first time you felt shame. There's nostalgia in both of those, you know, in a different way. It's just a sort of different proximity to the feeling, to the thing. And then the whole nature of memory, the fact that we remember most what we remember most often, and we've got kind of our greatest hits that we like to tell at parties and with, you know, people we meet. And we modify those every time we revisit them. So there are a lot of ideas to explore here musically. And I'm still at the stage now with the project where it's big. And then as we get closer to, you know, finishing this thing, it'll be winnowed and sanded and polished. And some of those bigger ideas will maybe fall to the wayside, or maybe they'll just more subtly inform some of the music.
Okay, very cool. Back to Whole Night Through soundtrack. Where can we listen to the album?
You can check that out on Spotify, Amazon, Apple Music. It's on YouTube. I have links to it on my website. You can find links on my Instagram as well. And then a bunch of other streaming services that I'm not familiar with myself, but they have, you know, the album is there. So if you Google it, you might have to scroll down once or twice, but it's around. And if you're into streaming music, and you know, pick your favorite streaming service, and it's probably there.
Okay, that is all my questions. Is there anything else that you want to bring up or talk about before we end?
One thing that I want to mention that I'm not sure if I already mentioned this, you can just, you know, throw this in the bin, but the idea of collaborating during COVID has been really interesting to me, because I've been more reclusive than I've ever been. And part of that has been really useful, because it's allowed me to focus and create something new. But then there's this other really cool thing about collaborating in a digital space where, you know, just as we're doing right now, we don't have to be in the same physical space to make something new, or to highlight something, or to think about something, share something. And I just think that a lot of people are feeling crushed by stay at home and by COVID. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with obviously the human suffering, the sickness, the loss of jobs, the, you know, all of these things are huge, but so much of it comes from being home, where home is a place where we charge our iPhones, eat food, and get ready to leave home to go and do our producing, to go and do our work. So I think there's something like salvation in developing a craft that you can do at home, where now your home becomes a productive space of sorts. And this doesn't have to be something that you end up selling or doing professionally, but, you know, to develop a practice, I think, is vital right now. And I think in the new year, it's going to be absolutely vital, because we're still in this, you know, and 2021 is going to be the year that it will be, but it'll, I think, unfortunately, be largely defined by COVID. And so this has been I guess I'm just saying to, you know, listeners that there's some hope here if we can look at this time as a way to grow as well. And you know, not to be minimizing any of the massive human suffering at all, but in fact, to look at that and say, okay, if it doesn't kill me, it can make me stronger. How might I grow right now? And I think a consistent practice, specifically with something art, but also, you know, language. I'm also learning ASL right now, and that's a lot of fun. And, you know, so to just stimulate your mind and try something new right now, it can change a lot. It can change your head and how you look at yourself and each other and the world. And so I would just extend that to other people. Get busy making stuff.
And you can do it on a budget too, right? Like you did.
You really can. You really can. And there are a lot of other people who are online and hungry for a collaborative project who will help, and who, you know, might have some words of wisdom to help you get started.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jonathan. The album's incredible. I loved it, just so you know. And I hope to hear more from you in the future. So thanks again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for listening to it. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
That was KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with Jonathan Maul. We've been hearing about Whole Night Through, a soundtrack to the novella in verse. That's a body of work which was released as a response to Eli Henley's novella in verse, Whole Night Through. Find more at jonathanmaul.com. That's Jonathan Maul, MAULE.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Up in just about a minute, Lisa Brennan Jobs and her memoir, speaking about being the daughter of Steve Jobs and growing up in a rapidly changing Silicon Valley. Let's go now to Emmanuel Rogers.
Speaking with us now is author Lisa Brennan Jobs. Lisa is daughter of artist Chrisanne Brennan, and Steve Jobs is her dad. Lisa's here to speak with us about her New York Times bestseller, Small Fry. Thank you for joining us today and taking the time out to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'll get my tongue untied in a minute and we'll continue on. Now, Lisa, your book tells of a story of you figuring out who you are and who you were from childhood to this day. It is an open and frank book. Why did you decide to write a book that includes information that most people don't want others to know about their home life and upbringing?
It's a good question. I think I couldn't really get the story right. I couldn't really get the joy out of it and make it a great story unless I was honest.
Okay.
And if I was honest about other people and depicted them with warts and all, then I certainly had to be honest about myself. But I guess another answer is that it turns out if you are open about what you're ashamed about, some quality dissolves, and it doesn't feel so bad. I read a book when I was writing this book, my own book, called This Boy's Life, and it's a wonderful memoir by Tobias Wolff. And I noticed that the more young Tobias was devious and even criminal at points,
okay,
but the more he was not so great, the more I loved him, the more he was imperfect. And it sort of opened the door for me to try to be honest about what I was ashamed about and where I had not been perfect. And that, in turn, made everything more interesting and more, I think, finally joyful and honest.
Now, I read through your book and all, and I'm curious. Did you have some perception of yourself that you should be perfect?
I think that there is a quality. I think people, even during the book tour, asked me about how I could love someone like my father who had been so imperfect. And I thought, but isn't that who we always love? Don't we always love imperfect people? I think there's a sort of narrative maybe in our culture about perfection or about shame that just isn't true about humanity. I think people have been very surprised that I wasn't trying to portray myself as slick and infallible. But of course, there would be no way to connect with other people if we portrayed ourselves as slick and infallible. And no one is.
No, and
so it seemed more useful to me to be honest. The other thing is that in some ways I wanted to understand what happened,
right,
with my family and what it meant. And it seemed like the only way to do that was to really get up into the weeds of it, to really go through it. The only way out of it was going to be through. And so I figured I would just I'd get messy with it and get honest about it, and then I would be free of it.
You know, that's just so wonderful, because I know I haven't been perfect since I was 13, and I think that was just for 2 months. So I was curious, have you ever met a perfect person?
No, I've never met a perfect person.
Okay.
But I think people project a lot onto other people.
Yes.
All of their wishes and their feelings that if they had been this way or that way, then this thing would have gone differently. At least I felt that way. I mean, for example, I hadn't really known my father so much when I was younger. And at a certain point, he decided to be more a part of my life, which was courageous and which was great. And my mother had signed on to take a class on Wednesday night, so he offered to take me. And so there we are. The first night alone together, we're driving to his mansion in his Porsche. And it turns out I have this father, and he's charismatic, and he's handsome, and he's successful, and he's interesting. It's like the dream of the fatherless daughter, really. And yet, he's not really saying anything to me on this drive. I don't know what he's thinking, and I think maybe he's not saying anything to me because he doesn't want to talk to me or he's not interesting. And it was only after writing this book and working on it that I realized, oh, he didn't really know what to say to a kid. He was just awkward. He didn't know what to say. It had nothing to do with me. And I think there are a lot of times like that in life when, especially as children, maybe we think we're responsible for something that we're not. And with this book, I got to go and keep my child self, you know, keep the child I was company with the adult who happened to know a lot more. And that was fun and reassuring.
Wow. Now, again, you are the daughter of two well-known people, your mother, artist Chrisanne Brennan, and your dad, co-founder of Apple, Steve Jobs. What were they like? What were your parents like when they were younger, and how did they come to be together?
Well, I think my father's a lot more well-known than my mother.
Okay.
They knew each other in high school, and they were high school sweethearts, and then it was a kind of on-and-off-again relationship, and then I was born sort of toward the end of it accidentally, or I was conceived. That was not intentional on anyone's part. And so then these two people who might have drifted out of each other's lives somehow were inexorably bound to each other in this way, and they're both of them very passionate, both of them very different, both artistic, creative. I think some of the values they had helped shape for each other because they were at that the age of formation in high school when they knew each other, when their values were developing. And it is interesting in some ways being different from both of them. I think I'm more methodical, I'm more calm and less passionate. And so I was there, a writer, born into this situation, and it was kind of an excruciating process deciding that I wanted to write a book, because who wants to be the kid of a celebrity writing a memoir? Not me.
Yeah.
But there I was, hoping to make sense of it.
Well, no, I'm glad you did, because what you did was you put down a lot of things that are just honest and about ordinary people who happen to be in some extraordinary circumstances. So I want to thank you for that. Now, in your book, Small Fry, you share with us that you were born on a small farm, and you were named by a man that, as you had said, he didn't think you were his. And I'm curious, what was the significance of that moment of you finding out how things had come about there?
So I guess I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, in that he had denied paternity, but I'm not sure that he really believed the denial in his heart. I think it was just not particularly convenient or happy to be such a young man, age 23, beginning of your incredible career, and find out you had a kid you didn't want to have. So he denied paternity, but I think he was well aware that he was my father.
Right.
And finding out about it, I had always known some aspects of this story. They had always been around. I think that the magnitude of the difficulty didn't really hit me until I wrote the memoir. I think that was maybe in part the reason that I wanted to write a memoir, was to understand who my father was and how bad it had been for my mother and how they had managed to keep on talking at certain times and communicating, even though this huge difficulty was between them of him denying paternity, and why he hadn't contributed money and what that had meant, and why later he'd wanted to come back and get to know me. And unraveling the mystery of my own life was part of the impetus to write this.
Right. Now, before we carry on, Lisa, will you share with our audience where they can find out more information about your book, Small Fry?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they can go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any other, or they can go to an independent bookseller, or they can look on lisabrennanjobs.net, myfullname.net, which is my website, and learn more.
All right, thank you for that. Now, one of the things that a lot of people really don't understand, if they hear who you are, they think that you come from the land of puppies, castles, and, you know, living in the clouds. What was your life really like growing up?
I think in some ways it did have a certain degree of castles and living in the clouds, because I was growing up in this gorgeous, golden, light, limpid air of Northern California in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And it was a time before the sort of current tech boom and tech money, and there was a lot of curiosity and ingenuity and many fewer people and no high heels. And so it was in some ways great, and this isn't a memoir of suffering. I had a therapist from when I was 8, which is a luxury in a certain way. I had went to some really excellent schools. So it has kind of the up and downs of many different childhoods, I imagine.
Yes.
But also I didn't have the luxury, I guess, or the sure knowledge of being on the inner circle with my own family. And that is a kind of haunting position to be in, to be on the inside and then be on the outside and then be on the inside. And I talk about how, like, when I would feel insecure at certain points, I wasn't supposed to talk about who my father was, but I would, you know, I'd take him out and brag a little in secret because it was something that I could, if I felt insecure, I could burnish myself with, even right. if it didn't feel quite real.
Now, this is an amazing thing because you speak about how you had some wonderful things going on, but also in the book, you spoke about your mom, yourself, and a friend of your mother's who committed the great couch caper at your dad's house. Will you talk to us a little bit about that and how it affected you seeing those police come in after you left?
I'm so glad that you've called it the great couch caper. I did not have the wits about me to call it that in the book, but I should have.
You can have it.
The beginning of the book, you see where I'm going around my father's house when he's sick and I'm taking things. It
yes.
was the weirdest thing. As I'm not really a thief, and I didn't shoplift when I was younger, but here I was taking these little things that weren't even of much value and feeling as if my whole life depended on it. And it didn't quite make sense. And then the next scene is when I'm much, much younger, and the book is mostly chronological, and I'm going with my mother to my father's house, even though I don't really know who he is. I think I'd met him a couple times, and he said we can take a couch because we don't have much furniture.
Right.
And so we get there to his house, but he's not there. He's kind of forgotten or something. But my mother had arranged for us to take the couch, so her friend is there to help us, and her friend has a van. And this sort of circumstance isn't going to happen again for us. We don't have the money to hire people. We need this friend. And so she's going around the house, knocking on the doors, knocking on the windows, trying to figure out an open door window so we can get in. And so in the end, they end up kind of stealing this couch from my father's house, and I was terrified that there was going to be an alarm, but then there was no alarm. And they got the couch, and we're in the car, and we're speeding away, and then these two cop cars come and pass us. And my mother and her friend joke, and maybe it was the police, they were coming for us. You know, they're happy, we've got the couch. But it turned out later, actually, he had a silent alarm. She called him, and he said, did you come and take the couch? And she said, yep. And he said that actually, I think 6 cop cars or something had come to his house.
Wow.
Because a silent alarm had rung in the station. And this was, of course, we would have been able to find our way out of this trouble had my mother been there. But as a child, I thought we might have been thrown into jail. So it's kind of haunting.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that. It's a wonderful book. And it is very open and honest about a lot of things that most of us just would not talk about as we got older. So I am so curious, what things in your life did you have to come to understand and reconcile about two ordinary but yet extraordinary people that happen to be your parents?
And I do think maybe lots of people are ordinary yet
yes.
extraordinary, and that's why the story has felt, even though it's so exceptional in some ways has felt sort of universal to people, is that people are ordinary and extraordinary. So I think that's a good way of capturing it. It was a lot of, I had to do a lot of unearthing of my parents and try to understand where they were coming from at different points. I think I was able to grow a lot of compassion for both of them. I have a child now, and he was born around when the book came out, which was its own crazy thing, mm-hmm. but also totally wonderful. And I think that it's true that having children is a momentous thing, and I definitely have compassion for my father in the ways that he was there for me and in the ways that he wasn't able to be, because, man, you miss out if you're not there for your kids. And I also had a lot of respect for the fact that he made one choice when he was younger and then made a different choice when he was older, which is hard to do. I don't know about you, but when I'm bad at something or when I don't know what I'm doing, it's hard to do it.
Yes.
And I think that he kept on trying to show up for me even though he was a bit awkward. And I respect that. And I think that memory and memory of sort of facts and emotions are kind of layered together. So in order to get at the facts, you have to feel the feelings, and it's a kind of iterative process that way.
Right.
And so I probably wrote like 7 books to get to this one book.
Wow.
just to finally distill down what the story was and what the scenes of my life that had particular meaning were. And so I think it was a useful process, sort of finding the story within the story.
All right. Well, Lisa, I want to thank you for your book again, because it has done something for most of us that we haven't been able to see, especially about your dad and how truly human he is and how he is just a person like everybody else that has to struggle with choices like the rest of us. So thank you for writing this book. I enjoyed reading it, and I look forward to whatever you have coming up next.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
You're welcome. You have a great day, and I look forward to hearing more from you.
Okay, take care.
All right, you too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Lisa Brennan Jobs, author of Small Fry, a memoir. That wraps up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Emmanuel Rogers and Lisa Brennan Jobs, and thanks again to Jonathan Maul. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, and Sharina Watt. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, NPR One, and Spotify, and most past shows are kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.